check and make sure that everything is working, which it looks like it is. All right, I guess we're ready to get started then. This is Jim Bowning of the Center for History of Chemistry speaking with Dr. Ernst Vollweiler as it is at his residence in Lake Forest, Illinois on 18th of August, 1986. Dr. Vollweiler, you were born on the 22nd of August in 1893 in Hamilton, Ohio. Can you tell me something about your father and your mother, their names and occupations?
Yes, both of them emigrated from Germany in the 1980s. And my father was a stonemason by trade. My mother came from a family who did cooperage in Germany. They were skilled craftsmen and controlled a company over there. But decided that they wanted to come to this country where there were more opportunities, and they had relatives here. They came in the 1880s, and my father first worked for a foundry in Cincinnati. Later he moved to Hamilton. And then in 1890 approximately, no, let me correct it, in 1882, small farm, and whether they had had some experience in their youth in farm life, I suspect they did, but I'm not sure. At any rate, they started farming in the year before I was born, which was 1882 then. And I grew up on the farm, and I feel it is a very happy circumstance that my parents did move to the farm in my early life, because it gave me a better background of life and contentment and ambition than city life would have. And I lived on the farm until I went to college.
I wonder if I might stop for a moment. I apparently there's a problem. Material that you're covering is fine. That's the kind of thing that we're looking for. Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I had an older sister and an older brother.
And you had all of your schooling in Hamilton then?
Well, in the country there, not in Hamilton.
I see. Was it a one-room schoolhouse, shall we say?
One-room schoolhouse, which I attended, and then I went to high school, in an area which is a very, very small high school, almost ludicrous, so small. And then I taught one of one-room country schools for a year, then I went to college.
Did you have any exposure to science in that one, in that small school?
No.
As you were finishing high school, had you given any thought as to what you might want to do, and why did you go to college?
Well, my brother, who was 4 years older than I, graduated from Miami University ahead of me, of course, and it was just so my parents were education oriented very much, considering particularly that they had not gone far in college, schooling at all. But my brother went to college, and I just naturally went in. Although my parents were poor, they didn't hesitate at all about putting what was needed into our training.
How did you acquire you spent 1 year, as I understand, teaching, what was the name of the school that you taught at?
Riley Township School, R-E-I-L-L-Y.
And you taught what grades, all grades then? It was another one-room school, was that? And were there any experiences that came from that? Had you thought about teaching permanently as a result of that?
It was a possibility, yes. I didn't plan too far ahead, but that is something I definitely had in mind.
And then you went to Miami in, I believe, 1911, is that?
That's right.
1911.
I'd gone to two summer school sessions, and my parents came from Germany, so I had a German background. We spoke German at home when I was a child, and so when I went to college, I went to the head of the German department, and I said, "I think I know enough German to pass an examination. Will you give me one and give me credit for it?" And he agreed. So I got 20 hours of credit, college credit, for the examination that I took under him. And that, together with two summer school sessions, enabled me to finish mine in 3 years instead of four. So it was very, very favorable.
What courses did you first take when you enrolled at Miami?
Well, the session was really the summer. I went to the summer school, and I took a course in history, and a course in chemistry. And the teacher there of that course was Professor Hessler, H-E-S-S-L-E-R, who was an exchange professor for that summer with Decatur University, Decatur, Illinois, Millikan. James Millikan University. He was the head of the chemistry department there, and for the summer he taught at Miami. And I took his course when I finished it, and some of my brother said to me, "Well, you seem to like chemistry a lot." I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Well, maybe you'd like to follow it up." And so that was the origin of my.
Do you remember anything about that course from Hessler? Did you do much laboratory work?
No, there wasn't. There was very little laboratory work. Most of it was lectures. But there was some laboratory work. And Hessler was a very good teacher. In fact, he became president of the Millikan University later. At any rate, I enjoyed the chemistry course more than the history course.
What summer was that? Was that prior to your full-time enrollment then?
Yes, it was. That must have been the summer of 1910 or 11. No, not 11. I don't think so. At any rate, I don't remember.
What other chemistry then did you take at Miami?
I took general chemistry, of course, and I took a course in organic chemistry and a course in physical chemistry. And that's all there was.
Do you recall who the instructors were? Especially
yeah.
The organic.
Dr. Harvey Brill, Dr. James Egan, Dr. Whitcomb, Dr. Oberfeld. Now, Egan was a University of Illinois PhD, so that's what influenced me.
Okay.
Considerable part to go to Illinois, to apply to Illinois. Brill was on leave of absence for that time in the Philippines on a federal government assignment of some sort, doing chemical work. Beyond that, I don't know. And Oberfeld was an instructor in chemistry and later went into industry and became vice president for research and development of the Phillips Petroleum Company.
Which of those was the organic chemist?
Egan.
Egan was the organic chemist. And is that where you then?
Well, so was Brill. Brill was definitely.
But you developed your. Is that where organic? Your interest in organic really developed then with. With Egan, or did that
later? Yes, with Egan and with Brill.
In these courses, again, did you have any laboratory experience?
Yes, at Miami.
Yes.
In general chemistry and in organic chemistry, had some laboratory work.
Did you do any research at all?
No.
Okay. And was your organic laboratory mostly, was it a lot of synthesis of material?
Just simple, straightforward.
Did you have any, as you were finishing up your education at Miami, did you have any thoughts about a career at that point?
Yes, it started growing at that time. And these men that I mentioned were stimulating people who could interest students in their fields.
Do you recall any other students? Were there many chem majors at the time?
No. No, there were not. and one or two who started out showing some interest and dropped and went in other fields later. there are very, very few who made chemistry a career. I don't know why that was, because I think the teachers were good and were stimulating.
What about math or physics? Did you take...
Well, no, I didn't follow up with math at all. Father said math was calculus.
And physics, did you have a physics course at Miami
yeah,
also?
I had a physics course, which is a good one, and that was headed by a man named Culler, Dr. Culler, C-U-L-L-E-R, who's head of the department, very, very good teacher. And I think he did some research in physics, but I couldn't lay my hands on it.
Now, you said that Egan was the one who influenced you towards Illinois.
Yes.
Had you thought about any other place besides Illinois?
Yes, I did. I applied to Harvard and to Princeton. And let's see, I think I applied to Michigan, but I don't remember. At any rate, I got an offer of a fellowship for $100 a year at Harvard, and an offer of $300 a year at Illinois.
Mm.
Illinois was closer, and the money was better, so I decided to go to Illinois. Well, I was sliding toward Illinois anyway.
I have a note here that I had also wanted to ask you about this. There was a summer at Miami when you worked in the iron mines up in Minnesota.
Yes.
An analytical chemist.
That's right.
How did you arrange for that position? Did that...
My brother was teaching high school in Hibbing, Minnesota.
I see.
And before the end of the school year, the preceding year, where I was looking around, he said, I think you might be interested in a job at the Oliver Iron Mining Company, which is a U.S. Steel company. It gave me a chance to do some chemical work to make a living as a chemist. Although it wasn't very complicated.
I was going to ask you what kind of work you did.
Straight analytical work.
Was it gravimetric iron kind of thing? Was
right.
That?
It's like gravimetric iron.
Was this done on the ore that was being shipped out before it was?
Yes.
I had read somewhere that you had planned to save that money to finance your last year at Miami, but when you returned to Ohio, you had a very small amount of funds left.
That's right. Exactly right. When I got back to mine at Oxford to start my senior year, I was really broke. That didn't bother me, because I got a menial job on the campus. I don't know whether I picked apples or what I did, but. Then I borrowed some more money from my parents.
And didn't you teach somewhere along at the end of the year at Miami? Didn't you do some teaching at Miami?
No, I was just a laboratory instructor.
Oh, I see.
Wouldn't be an instructor in the formal sense. I was a lab assistant, that's what it was.
When you first got to Illinois, you worked for Derek. How did you select Derek? Did you do research with Derek for a thesis?
I started in, and Derek gave me a small research problem to work on, and just how I, well, he was head of the organic division, so that's where I ended up for that year, that first year. Derek was a very enthusiastic, driving, very loyal to his students, very much interested in what you were doing. He was really a pepper-upper.
Were there many students in that organic division when you entered?
No. There, in the organic division, there's about five.
Five? Mm-hmm. Do you recall any of them, who they were?
Yes, there was Rainfuss, R-I-N-D-F-U-S-S. Who went into the paper industry and had a premature death. Hmm. He died after about 5 years in industry. There was Howell, Lloyd Howell, who later headed the chemistry department at Wabash College. And Potter, P-O-T-T-E-R-F, who came down from the University of Chicago, and died at Illinois a few years later of typhoid. Hmm. Those are the ones that I remember.
What kind of work did you do on your thesis? This was a master's thesis you were doing with Derek,
yeah,
is that correct?
That's right. Well, I couldn't even tell you the exact description of it now. It was a very simple organic chemistry synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
It involved trimethylene oxide. That's one thing I remember. No, I can't carry you any further than that because I've forgotten the details. And it was a simple problem in organic synthesis.
What courses did you take when you started?
I took a course in organic chemistry.
Was that with Derek? Was he teaching it?
The physical chemistry with Washburn. That was my minor. I don't remember if I took any other chemistry courses that first year.
And were you on a teaching assistantship?
That's right.
So you were instructing in the laboratory.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for 2 years. First year it was $300, second year it was $400. Third year it was $500. And my last year required no teaching. It was a straight fellowship. And paid me, I think, $400 or $500. And with the organic preps, which I'll come to later, I was able to pay all my expenses during those 4 years. From the income from the fellowships or teaching assistantships and the summer work.
You, as I understand it, you were going to leave after the completion, or you were thinking of leaving after getting your master's degree, is that correct?
Not quite. I didn't know whether I could finance the last year, but I wanted to go after the PhD.
I had read somewhere that Paul Anders, who was the glassblower, the department glassblower, had told you should stay. Is that?
Yeah. I don't know where you got all these little details, but if you want that story, I'll tell it to
okay.
you. In the fall of 1915, things were in somewhat of a ferment. So we'll come back to it. See, I came there in the fall of 1914. I was there in 15 and 16. Fall of 1916, yeah. Things were in a turmoil because Derek had decided to take a job as research director of the National Animal Company at Buffalo, which became Allied Chemical Company. And Derek was an impatient man. Somewhat flighty, and they offered him the headship of organic research at National Animal Company. And he offered job as chemist to a man named Derry, a man named Bissell, who also had received this was 2 years. After 2 years under Derrick at Illinois, Derrick offered Bissell a job, and he offered me a job as research chemist. Derrick accepted, I did not. But then the following fall, we were back as graduate students. working toward the PhD. And there was a man named A.B. Davis, who was with Eli Lilly at the time, but for some reason he was leaving Lilly to become vice president and research director of the Alton Wyborg Company, which is an ink manufacturing company in Cincinnati. Fairly good size. They thought they ought to have some research. Davis, I don't know how he got my name, he offered me a job. And that job was to be in research. I don't know what the research in ink would lead to. Was to pay $1,800 a year. Well, at that time, coming to the university for the PhD, we're generally getting only $1,800 a year. So it looked pretty good. And after several discussions, I talked to Dr. Adams in the meantime, who was new there, because he had just come. I had switched over to him. He had accepted me as a graduate student, and when this offer came along, I discussed it with Dr. Adams, and he didn't discourage me. He just said these are the pros and the cons, and he didn't try to talk me out of it. he was a new young professor there, unknown. People were wondering what was going to happen to the department. And so he didn't feel like taking a strong position to talk me out of it. And so, after a little turmoil at that kind of I met Anders in the hall. Anders was a German glass blower, and he stopped me and he said, "Vollweiler, I understand you're going to quit your graduate studies. You're going to take a job." He says, "Vollweiler, you're a damn fool." He said, "You mark my word." Said, in Germany, if you don't have your doctorate you can't be likely to be become head of a laboratory, research laboratory. He said, "Look, get that way here. You mark my word." And I went on. And I thought about that. He said, "You'll get that way in this country." And so I thought about it, and the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, Paul Anders made sense. So I went and talked to Dr. Adams, and I said, "Dr. Adams, I've changed my mind. I'd like to continue with you. You take me." He said he would. And that was it.
Now, you had started, I'd like to move to those summer organic chemical manufacturing.
Oh, yeah.
You had started, let me get my dates right, I think it was in the summer of 14, Derek was employing people to do those preps just for the what was needed in the fall courses,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps for some research. And by 1915, when the war had started, things had changed. Did you start the summer work doing that in the summer of 1915?
That's right.
And so Derek was still doing that first
Derek.
Summer.
That's right. Wait a minute. I think maybe I'm here. See, the summer of 14, I wasn't even on the campus.
Right.
Summer of 15, Derek had hired me at 25 cents an hour to make preps. This is the summer of 16 now. When Derek was still there, but it was during that summer that he accepted the job at National Anlin.
Okay. And so Adams wasn't directing those preps in the summer of 16
no,
yet?
No, not in the summer of 16. Not in
okay.
The summer of 17.
17.
He
mm-hmm.
was in charge. He saw what Derek had in mind, how he was doing it. And embraced the idea and followed it up very effectively. And he introduced cost controls. And developed the program so it was important by the summer of 16 thereafter.
What kind of preps did you do those first two summers, do you recall?
One prep that I remember was chlorpicrin.
Hmm.
Chlorpicrin, the military, we weren't in the war yet, but getting ready to do some. So they needed a kilo of chlorpicrin. That was my first job. Of course, we didn't know anything about it, so we knew it was hot substance. We didn't have too good facilities for working with toxic substances, but we were careful and we got by. That's one. I don't remember all the
but they were war related materials.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of facilities did you have? What were the labs like at that time?
Oh, my most vivid recollection lab was the inadequacy of venting fumes. Quite inadequate. example, I had some product to make. Which I had to use this pentachloride, the chlorinating agent, and the woods just wouldn't carry it away at all. So I'd take these Keldol flasks and put the ingredients in there and start walking. And I'd do it at night so it wouldn't be poisoned. So I'd go down the hall shaking it to mix it and go around the square building, you know, and I'd walk to keep ahead of the fumes, and then by the time I got all the way around, well, they were pretty well dissipated.
How many other students were employed in those first, in the pre-Adams summer period?
Probably four or five.
Do you recall who they were? They the same people that were in that?
Yes, one of them was Marvel.
Okay.
I don't remember who the others were. I should remember, but I don't.
Now, when you first started your work with Adams, how did you select the problem for your PhD? Did Adams assign that to you, or?
He suggested several problems.
Now, was the summer prep work the fall? That would be the summer of 17 when Adams started doing that. That was not related to your PhD work?
No.
That was separate. And, excuse me, Adams was synthesizing, was it the barbitol and procaine at that time?
Yeah, they came a little later. They came a year or so later. When Adams and Cam working together were interested in drugs, anesthetics and hypnotics, principally.
Did Adams came to Illinois with that interest, didn't he? He had already been doing some work in that before he.
I don't think so.
It developed at Illinois.
Yeah. No, he didn't. Interest with him. I don't know. You see, the pressure of the war had developed somewhat more by that time. By the time Adams had come and spent, say, a year there. Adams was smart enough to see some possible problems of interest there. His own work.
Mm-hmm. But that developed before the Abbott connection was made.
That's right.
Okay. In fact, somewhere I recall he tried, was it Mallinckrodt that he tried to interest first?
Yes.
And so you had some experience in the synthesis of these two materials before. When would that have been? The summer?
Well, that didn't come until somewhat later. That came in the second half. That came during the last second half. Let me put it this way: that came during the first half of 1917, I suppose it would be.
And were these prep these the prep materials for the war effort, was that becoming more and more of
we didn't get a lot of that.
I wanted to ask you too, how many did you make these in large quantities? Were they?
Oh, if we made a kilo, that was a pretty good sized quantity.
Okay, you completed your PhD work in 1918. And again, let me ask you, had you thought of career plans as that was coming to a close? The war was ending?
Yes, of course, industrial chemistry was still a rather new field, but it got into our consciousness that we didn't necessarily want to go into teaching or plan to go into teaching. These industrial jobs would look interesting too. So it was kind of a toss-up affair as to whether we were interested in that. Pretty generally true. I think the attitude of all of us was pretty similar. If there was a good teaching job, that certainly was of interest to us. If there was a good industrial job, that was more unusual, though, because we were just getting into the stage where industry was hiring chemists.
And let me ask you how the abbot position came about. I've read different accounts of how you made that first connection with Abbott.
I made it, or how Roger Adams made it?
You're
talking about me.
Yes, how you secured that first position at Abbott.
at that time, middle spring of 1918, Adams was already doing consulting for Dr. Abbott, and they had accepted a contract from the Navy for several drugs: barbitol, barbitol, procaine, syncofen. And they had a few chemists, not many, and it hadn't come through yet. They had a Navy contract for a considerable quantity of those drugs. But had run into some problems in producing. So Dr. Abbott talked to Dr. Adams about it. And they agreed that they ought to have some more manpower on these problems. So they had me, Dr. Abbott got in touch with me and told me to come up, which I did on a Saturday. I remember that. So he then hired me, and the job looked interesting to me. So I agreed to come up a couple of months later and start work. By the time I had my PhD. Dr. Abbott was a very dynamic man, and he really could interest and inspire people, whether he was personally acquainted with the field or not. then hired me, and he lived for a few years only, and then was succeeded by Dr. Burdick. Now I'm getting the head of the game, and
all right. Well, I wanted to ask you, did Abbott explain what you would be doing if you joined the Abbott Labs?
Yes.
Did he have a plan in mind?
Yes. Dr. Abbott, although he was a physician, had a research sense. He was interested in research. And Dr. Burdick, who succeeded him, was even more adept in that field. And so they wanted to follow a research program. They didn't know what. They wanted to develop new drugs, or old ones if they could be done possibly. So that is what they hired me for, it was a nice job to have, because it was new. Had a lot, didn't have to ask for permission for every step that I took. They encouraged me to do that, and it worked out very satisfactorily.
When you joined in late spring of 1918, were there other chemists, or were you one of the first, let's say, synthetic organic
chemists?
There were
a few synthetic chemists, just a few, and none was hired at that time, just taking a short period, say 3 months or 6 months. I was the only organic chemist who was hired within that, say, quarter of a year.
And you were told that you would be working on developing new. This was about it. Wasn't this a transition period between natural products,
mm-hmm.
extracting natural products, and beginning to move into the synthetic area? Was Abbott looking specifically at that?
Yes, definitely were.
Did you have many interactions with Abbott in those 2 years that he lived after you joined? Did he come through the lab when you were working?
Yes, he did. He'd come to the lab every once in a while. He was a go-getter. Sometimes he went go-getting the wrong way. But he had the courage to do things. And his batting average was pretty good. A man whom he knew, Dr. Summers, came to him. New processes for making phenacetin, drug phenacetin. that had kited in price terribly, hardly available anymore from Germany. So Dr. Abbott decided that something, phenacetin was not available from Germany anymore, and there's a demand for it, considerable demand for it in this country. So he bought this process. Well, this man had a small setup to make phenacetin, he thought, in Pennsylvania, and Dr. Abbott talked to me about it, and I said, Dr. Abbott, I hope you won't invest in this, because it can't work. It has the groups in the wrong position on the ring. They were ortho and they should be para. He listened, but he wasn't convinced. And this man was a good salesman. So Dr. Abbott bought the process, and he came up to the laboratory to tell me that he wanted me to get involved. And I said, Dr. Abbott, it can't work. It's like building a brick house out of a frame out of London. And he didn't listen, to make a long story short. He later decided to go ahead anyway. He came up to see me, but I was gone. I was getting married. So he sent a man working with me, Elmer Fleet, and he spent a month there, and he'd write me a note. There was, I was back by that time from my honeymoon. He'd write me a note and say, well, we put the intermediates into the pot and turned on the heat, and the thing went poof, and that was it. That happened several times. I'd try to get Bleak back, and Dr. Abbott finally gave up after a month or so on that. But then we started developing drugs in a limited way, fast as we could. We tried to do some research alongside the development of drugs that were already known, that were mostly ex-German drugs that were no longer available in this country. So that was the start of our synthetic program.
I believe that when you first arrived, you were assigned working on the production of procaine and barbitol. Abbott was in you were assigned to that, and I think, was it Adams who said you were a technical laborer? Was that a term that he applied?
I never heard it.
I read that somewhere. I think it was Adams who had said somewhere that you were really a technical laborer in those early days in the production area. So could you tell me something about the production of those materials?
Well, it was feasible, all right. And the only thing is that equipment was scarce and not readily available, the kind of equipment. For example, a pressure vessel was practically unavailable, and the kind that we needed was just generally not available. So we had to make do with what was possible and wait for the availability of the equipment that they really want. To that extent, that term is right, because what does technical labor mean? no matter who it was, he had to do the same work. That work had to be done.
What was your involvement in the production? Were you out in the plant?
Yes.
You were.
Yeah, I was in the first year. I spent all my time in the plant. Then we had some new laboratories for that time, and we started developing those and doing some research on new products, new compounds.
The idea of working on anesthetics, was that Adam's influence? Was that Abbott's suggestion? Was
yes,
that your
first,
suggestion?
The first interest came from Adams at Illinois in the year 1718. Adams and Cam were working on local anesthetics, starting with procaine, novocaine. And Adams turned that work over to me and that later. And that developed the anesthetics called Butin and Butesin, and those were marketed in the early 1920s. And we did manufacture barbitol in that period, and from that
somewhere I read that you called butyl alcohol a building stone, that when the war was over, some of these new alcohols became commercially available.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed you to now start to synthesize more materials than would have been possible. Is that?
Yes. Well, you see, that time, quite a number of new alcohols became available. Never been available before.
During the period, let's say the 1920s, sort of put that as a 10-year period. You were the title was chief chemist that time. Can you describe what that meant? How many chemists were there at Abbott in 1921 when?
Oh, I don't think that there are more than a half a dozen. About that.
And during that 10-year period, there were a number that were brought in. Were you responsible for locating these people and hiring chemists, or was that done by?
No, I did that.
And how did you find out about, how did you recruit new synthetic people?
Oh, I'd talk to the heads of the departments generally, like Gomberg at Michigan, and Adams, of course, I direct line to it. And as a source, I'd go around to maybe twice a year and meet people that are coming along.
Did you have any relationship at the University of Chicago?
Yes, we did. The Stieglitz, he had a quite close relationship. He acted as a consultant on certain problems, and as the work went along, we talked to him every once in a while. He was quite cooperative with us.
Did you use Gomberg as a consultant?
No, not as a consultant. To a degree. Certainly used him as a consultant with relation to personnel.
Mm-hmm. But not on technical problems.
Not on technical problems, no.
Were there any others besides Adams and Stieglitz that you called on?
Well, as I said, Gomberg and let's see.
Tell me something about how you started. I think you started by modifying existing products. You said you were doing that as well as working on the old ones. And that in 1923 you had Neonel. Is that how did that?
We marketed that for a while, but then it was superseded by some other
things. Did you make a large number of compounds? Did you just try to make as many derivatives as possible of, let's say, the original barbitol or barbituric acid?
Well, we made all those that we could think of as being available intermediates. The availability is really an important thing.
Can you tell me something about Tabern? He came to Abbott around 1926, and I believe you were responsible for bringing him.
That's right.
What kind of a person was he?
A very intense person. A man of boundless energy. Great drive and enthusiasm.
His first assignment. You were already in the middle of something, I believe, when he...
Yeah, I was working on Nimitol, and I made the ester for Nimitol. Hadn't been able to finish the job because I had other things to do. And so I gave it to him, and he finished it in good short order, and we put the product on the market. Quite successfully.
Do 1923, you commented in an article that there was a tendency to press on for new therapeutics before old ones were completely studied. And part of that rested in the pharmacological testing of these materials. What was the situation like at Abbott in the 20s?
Well, pharmacologists are hard to find. There weren't many, and pharmacologists themselves, the established people in the universities, looked down their noses at any pharmacologist or any person that go into industry. That was an awful thing to do. They had no respect for pharmacologists who went in the industry. And it took a long time to overcome that in part.
So what kind of testing was going on at Abbott then?
Well, we had several pharmacologists, but that wasn't nearly enough.
And at this point you were turning out a number of...
And at this point we were turning out quite a few compounds, which we wouldn't have tested.
Now, I think you used people at Wisconsin, Tatum at Wisconsin, and
yes,
Lundy, was it Lundy at the Mayo Clinic?
Lundy at the Mayo Clinic, he was an anesthesiologist.
How did you develop that relationship with them?
Well, before that, members of our medical department and others too would go up there and see what was going on, what was new, find some direction and worthwhile projects. So we became acquainted with these people and had a good relationship with them. And it worked out.
How long did you retain that relationship with them?
Well, I think we still have it.
Still have it? Okay. I was interested to note that this year is the 50th anniversary of pentothal.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1936 when it was introduced in the market.
Okay.
Could you tell me something about how that originated?
Well, at that time, at the start of it, we were making seed-producing compounds and submitting them. And then also Lundy at Mayo's and Waters at the University of Wisconsin Medical School were looking with interest at these compounds that we'd submit seed-producing drugs, but they looked on a kind of side effect or a different use to produce preoperative sleep, or anesthesia rather. And that's the way that started out with Nembutal, but Nembutal didn't quite have the anesthesia aspect that they wanted. So when pentothal came along, that was just one of many compounds that we made for them. And David and I were in close carried on this work jointly for several years, and Tabern did most of that because he could spend full time on it, and he was very, very good. He turned out scores of compounds.
The original suggestion to put the sulfur in place of the oxygen, how did that come about?
Well, it's just a logical extension because we knew, we had Nemutal, for example, which had the sleep-producing properties. And so we wanted to find out whether by modifying that molecule we could get improved results. And it was logical to replace, well, what we wanted to do was to put different groups in that molecule, various places, any place we could. And one of the places was where the sulfur was put in, and that was the real breakthrough, because we made scores of compounds after that, and many of them contained sulfur. There was other groups. Pentothal is the best one.
Were there previous examples of sulfur replacing oxygen in any of the other series? Or was this a...
No, there weren't too many places where we could fit sulfur into the molecule. But we put sulfur not only in this molecule, but a number of similar ones where the structural changes were made in the non-urea part of the molecule.
This period through the 20s was a very intense period for you and Taborn and others, synthesizing an enormous number of molecules. During that time, what were you... there are three things I wanted to ask you about. Let me put them all together. What were you reading? Who were you talking to? And were you attending meetings, ACS meetings or other meetings? As part of all of this development?
Answering the last part of your question first, the company was always quite generous in permitting the research people to go to meetings in their fields. So that was one thing.
Were these primarily ACS meetings that you were attending?
Well, a lot of colleges would have important meetings in those parts of the country. Bacteriologists. Quite a few disciplines that were followed up at these meetings that we attended. Now,
what were you reading at that time?
Well, we were reading the described research going on elsewhere, and that is the Journal of Chemical Society, the Pharmacologic Journal, the journal that the biologists used. So, if there was a chance of new compounds, physiologic action is diminished. We were, of course, interested because if we were removed, the eye open, find out what compounds are being developed that were of potential interest to the physician.
Were you getting input from the medical community, from the physicians in the field at all, or were they just on the receiving
end? Yeah, so far as the activity that they wanted, there was input, definitely. So far as specific compounds concerned, of course, they were not that source.
Were you in touch with your counterparts at the other pharmaceutical companies?
To some extent, so long as it didn't disclose it.
I was just wondering whether you got together with these people, let's say the other research directors or synthetic people.
The most prominent of that was the development of penicillin. Perhaps are off, and the Department of Justice agreed for a while to not prosecute us for collusion.
That's one of the things I wanted to talk about. What was the size of the research staff, let's say, into the 30s, through the late 20s, into the early 30s?
The entire research staff? Well, I wish I had a photograph here. I imagine. I ran across the photograph in the early 30s not long ago, and I would say that there must have been 50 or 60 people at that time.
Would it be possible, I'm curious if you have an old photograph, would it be possible that we could make a copy of that if you could locate it for us sometime? We could identify the people. It would be interesting to have a photograph of that period when the identification of the people.
I'll see that.
Okay, that would be great. We can copy it and get it back to you then. In 1930, you were named director of research, but I understand there was already a research committee that existed, and you were chairman of that. Who else was on that? When did that research committee start, and who else was on that committee?
Well, I can't tell you when it started.
Was it sort of an informal arrangement initially?
No.
No?
It was Dr. Burdick was still alive, and Dr. Burdick died in 1933. So it was in the late 20s. And no, it was set up on a more or less formal basis. We got regular meetings and minutes, and
who else served on that committee? Burdick was on it. Was he?
No, he was sort of ex officio. No, he was not. I was chairman. Dr. Dean, the medical director, was on it, and Mr. Nielsen, head of pharmacology, was on it, and Dr. Cromwell, bacteriologist, was on it, and it took off from there.
When you became, well, I wanted to ask you something else about Burdick. You had already indicated that he was quite involved and supported research. How did that translate into dollars and facilities and equipment?
Very good support from the top
Burdick involved the way, let's say, Abbott was? Did he come through the labs and talk to you?
Occasionally, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did he give direction? Or did he allow you to develop on your own?
He would give directions broadly and saying, look, here's a new product that was developed at the University of Wisconsin. I understand you're going to do anything to speed it up and put more manpower on it. So.
But many respects, you were free to develop in the in which way?
Yes, they left that pretty much to the research people.
I've forgotten who took over from Burdick when Burdick died in 1933. Did that have that transition have any effect on research? What was Clough's attitude toward?
Clough was supportive, really very supportive, and then with imagination and drive, did very well with the research.
Was it also in the 30s when Abbott moved into the vitamin field? I think it was the late...
No, that was the 20s.
Oh, it was the 20s?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That gave Abbott the income and a lot of activity that represented a good deal of growth in that period.
Did you have any involvement with that vitamin development?
Not so much. I was mainly left Nielsen, Carl Nielsen.
I have another statement from Roger Adams, who said that your greatest service to the medical profession was the ability to forecast trends and needs and to sense the potentialities of embryonic developments. How did you sense the areas that needed to be followed?
I don't know how well I sensed them, but if someone is really interested and gets deeply involved, these things he's going to follow the literature, he's going to follow the state of the art. So, there's nothing unusual about that. It's just it's an activity you have to engage in to know what's going on. If you know what's going on, you're supposed to put things together and come up with something.
During that period prior to the war, because once the war started, there were a number of other things that happened.
About World War II.
Yes. But you published a number of papers throughout the 30s, primarily with Taborn, primarily the barbiturates and other hypnotics, also with Loeffler and with Moore, but primarily with Taborn. I noticed a number of those were presented at ACS meetings as well. How did you work the patent rights on a number of these things, but still publishing the synthesis?
Well, by the time it got published, the patent was supposed to be underway. Mm-hmm. We ran into a number of interferences, so-called, in the patent office, where other scientists would get involved in the field that we were in. But Commissioner's office, so I taken care of that, worked out all that. The potentially most troublesome one could have involved Pentafowl, but it didn't, because there were at least three firms who worked on that and got involved in the patent question. The rights and respective rights of the individual units could be identified, and so it worked out all right.
Who were the other companies that were doing the same, working on that?
Park Davis and Shot and Dome from Virginia.
Did those patent problems tie up the marketability of it?
No.
Okay. During World War II, there were during World War II, Abbott was heavily involved in the production of a number of things, and of course your role was crucial in terms of being a research director. The first one, and perhaps the major one that I wanted to talk about, was penicillin.
Yes.
And you've already mentioned that. Could you tell me something about Abbott's involvement in the penicillin production?
Well, it, of course, was the major project that time, not only in for itself, but in the potential discovery of other compounds like penicillin or involving some kind of activity. of course, when the information became available first regarding penicillin and its amazing properties, well, everybody got involved, including Abbott. And I think we did a pretty good job on that because we developed the process and carried on some research on things related to penicillin, but not penicillin itself. That really set the train going. I don't know. To what extent we could have done a bigger job, a better job, I think we did pretty well. not only with penicillin, but in the development of streptomycin, and there are a number of the various pharmaceutical firms. There are quite a number of antibiotics, not all of which by any means survived. Some of them got as far as the market and then failed.
In terms of that open cooperation with your previous competitors, Merck and Squibb and so on, did you meet with your counterparts at the other companies on a regular basis?
Only in the early days.
Only in the early days.
After that, competition decimated them appreciably. in some cases, the products under question were marketed by several firms but dropped out, but they weren't particularly important.
In terms of the penicillin, Adams was on the OSRD committee, and did you meet with him in those early days of the penicillin production? Did you have any contact with him during that time?
Well, we kept in touch with him about that time, but really the involvement of Adams in production of penicillin was not very great.
You, the company also was involved with blood plasma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a matter of equipment mainly. How to evaporate the water from the blood plasma most effectively, and several methods during that period were developed which got into actual production. That's where freeze drying at first got its real start.
What about sulfa drugs? That was another.
Yes.
Abbott had been making those before the war, hadn't they?
That's right. Sulfanilamide, sulfadiazine, sulfathiazole.
Was that just a matter of increasing production then?
Yeah, well, we spent quite a bit of time and effort on new sulfa drugs. while they were not quite a bit, in the case of drugs like sulfadiazine, sulfadiazole, we were not responsible for important new sulfa drugs. Originally responsible. The patent situation of a number of the new sulfa drugs was not very clear, so that nobody really had, in many cases, in case of a number of products, no one company really controlled the whole field.
Your involvement as research director at this time during the war, the Second World War, was I'm sure quite crucial. Can you tell me something about how the company geared up to produce large quantities and the extra effort that was made during that time?
Well, the extra effort involved more personnel, also involved more equipment, and also involved more buildings to take care of that equipment, because you could say, well, we're going to put a lot more equipment on this project, but unless you have a barn to put it in, it's no good. It's inadequate. So the building program was one thing that was undertaken pretty early and very actively. Then new equipment, of course, that can follow if you have the demand, where equipment can be bought and installed as quickly as possible. So that went pretty well for those products.
Was there any effect when the war ended? The demand for many of these things must have changed.
Well, not as much as you might think, because the products were in great demand still, and the company tried to anticipate that by directing more money into and activity into research on these products, like the antibiotics. That was followed the war right along. It didn't stop.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the war, you made a trip to Europe for the military.
Yeah.
Quite curious about your experiences in that. There were a number of people who went to Europe as the troops moved into Germany. Could you tell me something about those experiences, how you were
involved in that?
Yeah, well, this is a very interesting development, because we didn't have any idea, or didn't have a good idea, about the kind of activity that the Germans were doing, and how intensive they were. So it gave us a good idea through Bayer and Hoechst and Bodischer. And our impression was, yes, they knew what they were doing. They had not developed on a scale that we thought they had. Their equipment was, they'd used more small batch sizes than we did in this country on comparable products. They had good relations with the universities. Their big committees of the big firms, in the big firms, were quite active in the businesses. They didn't mind getting involved deeply in the production of medicinals. They were, when we went over there, we didn't know what to expect, how resistant they might be to disclosing information. Well, of course they dragged their feet some, but they were quite cooperative in general.
Did you follow the troops in? When the troops moved into a city where there was a plant or a...
Oh, they were scared to death, and they were very cooperative. In general, they were frightened. Of course, they tried to hide some things if they could get by with them, but in general, it worked out very well.
Were the troops present? Were there any troops present when you went into to talk to the Germans? Did they?
No, not in the room in which you talked to the Germans.
But the plan had already been.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got into the Ruhr, for example, where Leverkusen, Bayer were. We got in there within two or three days, and the troops went in. So we got them fresh, and a byproduct that we were not assigned to was war gases. And Bayer's. Without growth of their work on agricultural pesticides, and a man named Schroeder, Dr. Schroeder, worked in that field with his assistants, and when the Wehrmacht found out about it, well, they took it away from Bayer and took it over beyond the Ural Mountains, where they stored 3,000 tons of this stuff.
Mm.
And I don't know, I haven't heard anything about that. But I know that that's still over there. Because, in the first place, I guess it's a very difficult job to destroy or inactivate a large quantity of war gas. We're finding that out. That's with the trouble we're having getting rid of what we've got, not finding new. went into, there were about eight of us in that year. When we went in to the Ruhr, we asked him, now we must know what you've been working on in the fields, and then they'd mentioned, including cultural chemicals and so on. And out of that came their statement, yes, they've done some work on agricultural chemicals, phosphorus-containing compounds, which were very toxic. And so then the matter of war gases came up. So we said to Dr. Schroeder, we want you to tell us everything that you can about Taboon and the couple of other war gases. So we left him with a big pad of yellow paper to write out everything that he knew about the development of the compounds. And we left him there all night. He worked at it all night. And next morning he gave it to us, and we looked it over, and we quickly dispatched a plane to Paris and another plane to London to the American headquarters there, who sent the information then to the United States. And that was the first information that we had in this country of what the German compounds were, the four gases. But that was an interesting circumstance. It grew out of their agricultural research, and I think it's true that they were not primarily interested in war gases, but they did develop war gases.
Do you think they were under orders to do that?
I don't know. I think they probably were.
You said there were eight in the team. Do you remember the names of some of the other people who were with you?
Fogler. White. Hot. H-A-U-G-H-T. Calcutt. C-A-L-C-O-T-T. Smadel. S-M-A-D-E-L. I think of it now.
Okay, what were their backgrounds? Were they?
Well, Spadell was a physician. He was a colonel in the army. Calcutt was the vice president of DuPont. Fogler was allied. I should remember White and Leeper's connections, but I can't call them off the fingertips.
Yeah. Did any of the information you uncovered in that trip prove useful to Abbott?
Somewhat in general, yes, and not in the matter of specific compounds, particularly They were vendors to us, but we never developed them.
Was this information that you acquired made available to all of the companies? Was it strictly government information?
At the start, when the war ended, we were not supposed to divulge information. That was never really spelled out, though. Some of that information was immediately spread pretty broadly. Later it was generally available, but as for specific products, it was not very extensively used.
Were the plants in the areas that you visited damaged heavily?
Oh yes, some of them were terribly destroyed.
Yeah. You were where? Dusseldorf and
Leverkusen. Hext. They were all pretty severely hit.
In the period after the war, you were then vice president, and Abbott developed a number of new products. Interested in your role in their development, thinking of antihistamines, anti-epileptics, and of course Sucral, which came around 1950, but I think the early work was much earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
I think 50 was the date that Abbott started marketing the Sucral. You tell me something about your involvement with those, with that post-war development?
Well, I that time was fairly close touch with the DuPont, the products that might be of medicinal interest, and we would have contacts fairly regularly as to products that might be of interest, and Sucral was one of them, because DuPont had the rights to it. But they thought the market was just a little too small to interest them, so they gave us the license to market. And I was pretty much responsible for that. Then later, DuPont decided, well, Abbott's doing pretty well with that. Maybe we ought to be in anyway. And, they did market Cyclamate for a while, but were disappointed in their results. So later they dropped out again.
How did you find out about this information originally from at DuPont? Was it just in a casual conversation?
No, I think it probably came through the University of Illinois, the people down there.
I knew
what it happened to it. Pretty general information. Oh, also Lilly had some rights from DuPont. And I don't know what they were, but they never marketed the product.
You were quite active in ACS affairs and were president
1950. What was the state of the society like in 1950 when you were president?
I think the society was growing pretty nicely during that period. There were about 65,000 members altogether. Now, I guess, how many are there?
About over 130,000 now.
Yes, I know it's over 130,000. Physically, the society headquarters in Washington and Columbus did very well. I think that we built at the right time. When you see the agenda for the council meeting and see all the reports and groups that have been active in Petty, it gives you pause because it's so extensive now, so such a big business. I've forgotten what the budget of the society is now, but the many millions per year.
There was something in CNE News about chemical abstracts. And I think you had reported, you wrote the title as Milestone or Millstone at that time. That was...
That was a worrisome period in that the society was growing so big. And the chemical abstracts, for example, how that grew and took in the foreign abstracts too. That was a marvelous job of organization, I think, Dale Baker. He did a very good job.
Of course, 1950, I suppose that post-war period saw a lot of
material being published that had not been published during the war, so that there was a large, an unusual increase in volume at that, I suppose, around that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, all the shortcuts and mechanisms that were developed in that period. But I'm concerned, I don't understand them. I don't understand the telemedicine.
When you became president in 1950, you dropped 300 products in the Abbott line. What was the, why did you start trimming at that point?
Oh, it never should have been kept on as long as they were, because cost more to promote them. The theory was, well, Dr. Brown over here, he swears by calcium, and if you don't sell him that anymore, if you adopt that, he's not going to be interested in some of the other parts. That's a false argument. We started trimming more effectively at that time. That's gone on now. It's much harder for a product, unless it's an orphan product, to stay in the list. What I mean by the orphan product.
Well, I think so, but
in the last few years, the Food and Drug Administration will accept the product with some favorable aspects if it's so small that it has a hard time staying alive. We had a product on the test for gout, and it, without question, was active, but the women wasn't gout. Is it epilepsy?
President since Burdick that was a scientist. Your predecessors, the people in between, were not scientists. Do you think that had any effect? What was your approach different than their approach, coming as you did through the laboratory?
I don't think so.
During that period, what did you consider to be your accomplishments as president?
Well, I think our standing as a scientifically based company was an improvement. developed a number of new products which are still very good, like the Ripps and things like that. Then the most marked change came about through the development of diagnostics, which started during my presidency. First, with radioisotopes, that has expanded and developed so much that in the third and a quarter of our total business is in the diagnostics division. The diagnostics direction has been a marked development and a very, very successful one. And that, of course, spreads out over many fields.
I believe it was it Tabern who developed the radioisotopes? Mm-hmm. Was he the one responsible?
Yes.
How were you willing, let me go back and look at what Dr. Abbott did with Summers and how he kept that going for some time before he realized there would not be any development out of that. How much were you willing to support development before you were, in terms of developing something that, how much were you willing to keep it going before you would say this isn't going to work and stop?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. Depends on the particular field of particular product, whether it's going to be a dead horse and gas and be a pen. I don't know how to answer that.
Okay. I guess what I'm looking at is, again, as a person who came through the laboratories, your approach to research, and its fundamental relationship to the development of the company.
Yeah, well, I don't think that is different. For the man who... We didn't come up through the scientific ladder.
You also continued what your predecessors did in terms of employee relations.
Employee relations have been very good right now.
I understand Dr. Abbott was very good, and even in his in the early days of taking care of employees and their problems.
Yes, he knew every employee, and he knew something about them personally. Adam now has a Clara Abbott Foundation,
which is an organization to give help where needed to employees and their families. Because you have to find that, whether it's eligible or not. Abbott also gives scholarships to children of Abbott employees.
In a time when many companies find themselves cutting back on research or having new products developed by acquisition of smaller firms rather than internal research, what is the situation in the pharmaceutical industry? Is that happening there also, or is
not to the extent you find in other fields, pharmaceutical industry has been relatively modest in the amount of absorption of other firms concerned. So that can change in time. Dow, of course, have gotten into it in recent years, not as much as they would like. DuPont has gotten into it, not as much as they would like. Monsanto to a greater extent. But I think that I think it's operating pretty well.
What comments do you have about developments today versus when you started in the drug industry? What are the current trends as opposed to what you've seen in your career?
Current trends are on such a vast and large base that it's hard to categorize it. The whole picture has changed a good deal.
Targeted either the sedatives, hypnotics, anesthetics, those are specific things that were targeted. Are specific areas still being targeted and then developments following that, or is it the other way around? Are people looking at new compounds and then seeing what they might be useful for?
Well, is not as important in my mind as it used to be. Where you target the appeals. I think that the synthesis that Paris for use of new drugs is just as important as it was, say, a generation ago.
Have anything that what would you say would be the future for a person starting out today that was as you did in 1918 with Abbott? What does the new PhD from Illinois have for him when he comes to Abbott?
Well, quite a few feet, quite a few ankles we didn't consider there. His possibilities are very good, but he's going to have to convince his employer that that he has a field or a direction which can lead to good new products. And used to be that I could go into a company and say, look, I'm an organic chemist, hire me. If he comes in then, well, he could work in quite a number of lines and synthesis of organic compounds. Now he's more likely to find a place in a specific field in a very highly, more highly specialized field. I just don't.
In today's business climate, is there still a possibility for a PhD scientist starting at Abbott to become president 40 years from now?
Well, I don't see why not. He's going to have a, some sense of balance of business understanding, and I don't know why he cannot say use his basic knowledge, his basic ability, with some business training, possibly an MBA, which is available now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he should have about the same chances that the man has who comes up to the business field and not to the science.
Well, I don't have any more questions, specific questions.
And well, I'm afraid I didn't answer your question very well.
Well, I understand that you're not feeling well also, but I appreciate it. Appreciate the time that you did take for to spend with me. It's been very fascinating, and I've enjoyed it very much. So, thank you.
Where do you go next?
I'm